So, when I wrote up, well, I guess it was not last yesterday, but a week ago yesterday, that I wanted to learn about uncertainties and understanding our uncertainties, I thought I was going to get taught it. So I'm a little surprised that now I'm giving a lecture, but on uncertainties. And so I'm not going to do that. I'm going to tell you. I'm going to probably drive you all out in this next word that I write here, and then we can all go and do work. But if you stay, then we can talk about what I think you can do once you accept this. In cellular evolution, we are actually, and I'm writing this down, and I mean it in the best way, we're engineers. And what I mean by that is we have recipes for the physics.
You should be so lucky.
Yeah, that's right. So
for you to strive for.
Yeah, that's and this is exactly what my talk is. This is something we want to strive for. This is something that is actually, if we do it right, if we take advantage of some of the engineering tools, and I will point out that that's my day job at Los Alamos. I am essentially an engineer, so I have my engineering hat on. So the rest of the talk, I'm coming from the engineering point of view. And the reason we are is we have recipes for the physics. We have the recipes for the physics. But we're, you know, these are recipes, because we're trying to model something that really is not a one-dimensional thing. It's not an implicit thing. And we're trying to do that anyway. So we have to, we're limited to recipes. We're limited to things that have fudges in them, have errors in them. And then what we try to do is we validate our recipes on observations. And this is a lot of astrophysics, not just stellar evolution, but I think stellar evolution is one of the most clear-cut cases. So this is what we're doing. And this is fine. This is what almost all engineers do. This is what, you know, you can't actually do the physics first principles in a lot of problems. You can't either resolve it or, in the case of stellar evolution, we're just very far away from it because we're doing things that are implicit that should not be done implicitly. We're doing a lot of matrix solves which aren't perfect, and then we're trying to see what kind of answer we can get.
So you're only talking about ridiculous implicit codes like MESA. You're not talking about all the purists who
are doing. But even if you're doing 1D trying to do hydro, you're only doing 1D. So even if I did it explicitly and I'm doing it 1D,
I want the 3D guys to get off the hook.
Well, and the guys, so we're gonna make fun of 3D in a bit. but let's. 3D is getting closer there, right? When we do 3D modeling, we get a little closer because some of the uncertainties go away.
Absolutely.
But we still have this thing where we put in an algorithm. And that algorithm is good or bad depending on what you've put in. So we are, especially in this kind of astrophysics setting where we're doing a lot of multi-physics, you either see us as applied physicists or engineers. In Los Alamos, we kind of combine the two. Technically, I still call myself a physicist, but I'm in a building surrounded by engineers. We're doing the same stuff. So I wanted to, get some of the lessons learned that I've kind of learned as working at Los Alamos, doing various projects on, you know, what's the engineering approach that, and how is that different than the astrophysics approach, or what can we learn from this engineering approach? And before I go too far, I just use the term validate, and there's actually, especially if you get funding at all from Department of Energy, any kind of these computational centers, they have this verification versus validation. Of codes. So they talk about doing this kind of work on the codes. So there's two terms, verification and validation. I'm not going to go into those much, but the general definition of verification and versus validation is verification is testing to see if your code solves the equations it says it's solving correctly. Validation is testing, do you have the right physics in your code? So those are the two. Now, in what happens in even in the engineering setting is they think if they compare to an experiment, they're only doing validation. And that, and I'm a purist, that's not necessarily true. But a lot of what we do in Los Alamos, when we say validation, we say that's comparison to experiment. So that would be comparison to observation, versus verification being something like a resolution study or a comparison to an analytic. So there's terms like this that the engineers will use. Now, I think I like the definition I gave is the strict definition. I like to follow it strictly. I'm a purist. So you can actually have an experiment that is verifying your code if you actually knew what your experiment was doing. And I'm going to make fun of a little bit of the experiments that we... So most of my lessons learned have been on trying to model experiments. Yes?
Thinking in MESA terms, as I always do, of course, that's sort of like the distinction between have I got MESA models that are converged in the sense I've cranked down time resolution and space resolution enough that it thinks it knows what the answer is. Is verification in a sense, only in the sense of it's sort of a first step, and then you say, okay, now that MESA seems to be converged on an answer, how does that compare to observation?
So another example of Another example is code comparison.
Yeah, absolutely.
Two codes that think they're solving the same equation, if they get the same answer, that's a very good question. So what are the lessons learned that we learned the hard way? At least I learned the hard way. One is understand your errors. So, I'm not saying anything. I'm not going to say anything new to any of you, but we're not necessarily doing this. And what I mean is you're doing a multi-physics problem, and you're trying to understand your errors. And my question is, are we doing that? How often are we really trying to understand our errors? So I'm comparing to an observation. If I'm not playing with all the parameters in my models, if I'm not doing resolution studies and also parameter studies and say, here's what my error is with what I know, if I'm just going and saying, here, I got a fit, and I go until I get a fit, then I'm not understanding my errors. And so I do want to show this plot because it's an example of an experiment where we went dreadfully awry. So what we did was we were doing it was a laboratory experiment. We had a tube. We were shooting a whole room with lasers, letting energy go through this tube, and we were measuring the time at which that at which the energy went through this tube. So we're just measuring how quick it was supposed to be, testing do we know radiation flow. Simplest radiation flow problem you could do, right? Radiation going through a tube. And we did the experiment. And when we did the experiment, we did a series of... we had a series of shots, and we compared it to our simulations. And what we found, I have it reversed. Well, it's good enough for what I was.
Top displays.
Is it an easy?
Top in the middle.
Oh, there we are. So, we had done this, we did a series of simulations. Every single time in the simulation, the radiation was faster in the simulation than it was in the experiment. And the solution that our first effort did was the equation of state or the opacity is wrong. And in fact, we did a study where we said, how can we get... The answer was that we were something like 0.6 seconds to... 0.6 nanoseconds. All of our experiments are in nanoseconds. 0.6 nanoseconds too fast. How are we going to slow it down? And so what we did is we both raised the opacity and we changed the equation of state. And that's all plausible. It turns out that with the equations of state we had, we were doing the energetics of ionization. We were doing all the solid state energy equation. What we weren't doing was really accurately the excited level states in our equation of state. And so we were getting the energy off some, and that can change your result. Opacity is being wrong by 15-20%. That's within reason. So that was our solution, and we said, okay, that's what we've learned. We've learned that we have these equations of state, or equation of state for, in this case, it was a CH foam. So the CH foam, something's wrong with it. But then I said, wait, well, we have lots of errors. We have errors in the tube is made with this foam. This foam is not homogeneous. It has some, we had measured it. There's some variation in it. When we first did our study, we looked at that uncertainty. We played with it. We said it's small. It's not 15, 20% in the time, so it can't be it. We looked at another error. It can't be it. We looked at lots of errors. We said none of these can be it. And in fact, all these errors, how are we going to explain this systematic shift? Because all of our shots, we were faster than when we were doing than the experimental results were. So I said, okay, let's put in the foam. Let's put in our uncertainties in the drive, in the drive spectrum, in the drive flux. Let's put in our uncertainties in the diagnostic and how it works. So we started putting in those errors, and this is the error analysis that we actually plot. So this was the nominal value that we got from our simulation. This is how big the errors were when they all added up. Right? That is how big the errors were. So this is the target errors. These are things like the foam density, these kinds of things. This is the drive errors, and this is the total errors. But what you also see is there's a shift. If I look at the mean value or the median value now, when I've sampled all of these, I've moved over. And it turns out this lines up right along where the shot data was. That would get us a more reasonable answer. In fact, if you started drawing from our sample, then you got a thing where sometimes we were long, sometimes we were short, but we had these errors. But what we hadn't done in the experiments before this is do a full analysis of our errors. And we're in this position with stars where if you're going to compare to some observations and you have only looked at one error, you may get the wrong answer. And so in the end, I argued that we can't tell if there's any errors in the equation of state or in the opacities from this experiment. Now, the issue with this experiment was we thought this was just our test experiment. It was going to be easy to do. We were going to get it perfect. And then we were going to go and do the next stages. And now we're still just trying to understand how radiation flows. It turns out probably the smallest error in this whole thing is the radiation transport scheme. So this was an experiment designed to do radiation transport, and we didn't get it. So I think understanding your errors and really putting that in is an important thing to do. And I know, because I wasn't here at the meeting, but I went and watched Frank's talk. Here's errors, and here's errors where they played with the resolution and with the network size, and they're finding errors that are not negligible. These are not small differences, right? So you can start getting differences by playing around with your physics.
So you see the attitude, they consider it as a different outcome, so you say it's errors.
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's a different outcome, because there is the things they're varying, there is a right answer, right? You know, it's just that we're not,
I think they describe it as uncertainties. Okay. So it's, obviously if there's one answer, you have uncertainties that you don't know what the right answer is. It's sort of true.
And before I stop, I have two more slides, and I'll show them, and then I'll be done with showing slides. I had one other thing, corollary, on this understand your errors, and that is resolution studies don't get you all the way there. They're not full verification.
Necessary, but not sufficient.
Yeah, and the reason is some things I'm not convinced you can resolve. A resolution study will get you there. And let me give you an example. We did this study with Paul Woodward. We compared the RAGE, PPM, and flash codes. So RAGE is a Los Alamos code. PPM is Paul Woodward's code, and then the Chicago flash codes. And we were doing an implosion, and we were doing... Now, the cheat we had in the flash is we're using a spherical coordinate mesh in it. These are both Cartesian meshes. So you can see this is a simulation where I'm doing an implosion. Here's with no perturbation. So I have no perturbation. I'm just doing an implosion, and I'm watching it implode. For something with a spherical grid, Not surprisingly, it does the implosion really well. With PPM or RAGE, which were Cartesian, we had some grid effects that caused a little bit of turbulence. If we input modes of turbulence, then the codes got more agreement and looked similar. So you start looking at these results, and you can start, really we're focusing on the growth of the turbulence in these. And for these different modes, they have a lot of features that are the same. What they have that are very different is kind of these mixed zones, like right here, you see there's a lot of yellow in that mixed zone, whereas here, there's some empty space. So it's how much mixing you're getting. Well, this depends on how you're doing your reconstruction in your algorithm. It's a difference in your algorithm. And you could say, okay, I'm going to just resolve that. If I get enough resolution, it shouldn't matter what my algorithm does. So we did a resolution study. And these quantities here are measurements of that amount of mixing. It's the amount of material that's not all of one material, well, not all of another. It's one where it's a mixed material. And let's just look at this. This is the most extreme case. But let's look at this case and see what we're getting as we try to, as we do a resolution study. So the red is the Los Alamos RAGE code. In this case, the black is the Berkeley-Castro code. And we started calculating the amount of mixing, and we started resolving, and we kept on getting more and more resolution. So these are using different levels of refinement. So one level, two level, three levels. Here's one level, two level, three levels. At four levels, we didn't get any kind of change, so it started to converge within the different codes. But there was a huge difference in the mixing between those two codes. So the two codes did not converge. And it's very hard to get enough agreement in. So this is where I put Paul Woodward. I said, this is something I don't think you can converge on. This is a quantity that you don't know. If you're really trying to get how many of these mixed zones that you have, how much volume has mixed material in it, which oftentimes we want, that's hard to resolve even in the multi-D. And one person's code might do it. They can do a convergence study and say, I've converged, I've gotten this answer, I'm good. But someone else's code will get a very different answer.
Each code is converging, but to different answers.
Yeah.
So this is because you're doing the ideal problem, right?
Yeah, well.
So the ideal problem doesn't necessarily have a unique answer. It's not necessarily well posed. So if you put in some dissipation that regularizes your small scale, you will get the same result in the different codes.
So no, and that would be great. So if I'm saying I have a, if I dissipate it like crazy, yeah. But in any problem that is what we're studying, this we actually, you know, we have a lot, you know, even if we up the viscosity quite a bit, you still get something that does not converge. So you can say that the Reynolds viscosity is higher. You're trying to solve the Navier, because in the end we're trying to solve the Navier-Stokes equations. If I smear it like crazy, yes, then everyone gets the same answer. The question is 100. It's 100% everyone.
Stability.
What?
I did a test of Kelvin-Hamilton stability at Reynolds number 10^6, so I think not too much dissipation. And I got the exact same solution in two completely different codes with completely different numerical algorithms.
So you can, at some point, I can tell you that we've tried, and there's a whole literature on people trying this. It's not just, so I'm not saying this is one project that says this doesn't happen. There's hundreds of, in the engineering field, this is well understood. So this is well accepted. So if you really want to, you know, this is not one paper that you'd have to argue against. It would be a lot of papers.
So, with a comparison of two codes, it's kind of, and no experimental data to guide you on the problem, you know, which do we say is closer to the right answer? You know, it'd be helpful to see more codes and more algorithms represented.
Yeah, so we could, and in this case we didn't because doing the resolution study was expensive. We had actually done more codes here. So here you see I have flash instead. It's actually the same project, but you can see even in here the answers are different.
Well, here I was wondering, it's kind of in the weeds, but is contact steepening on in PPM in Paul Woodward's code?
I have to remember what he put on for this one. Certainly, we had contact steepening on ours.
Because they're often little switches, and you see a comparison like this, and it's like, this is the result from flash. This is the result from PPM. This is the result from RAGE. And if you were to change one Boolean or, you know, adjust one little, you know, numerical threshold in some of these algorithms, it completely changes the way it treats.
Yeah, exactly. So we have run this both. So we played with, you know, RAGE has context deepening. You can do it. You can turn it off. It does make a different answer. Neither of them do we know which one is the right answer. So you can do it. It's just the issue is you still are in the situation where, because there's reasons why, in fact, I think these calculations, we turn the steepener off because the steepener was causing other problems.
Right. So I mean, I find myself in this situation with Mesa quite a lot, actually. There are the spatial control panels worth of switches and parameters. And I don't know for a given situation whether I can just live with it at all, or whether I should be changing it. And if I change it, and it makes the HR diagram trajectory go like this instead of like that, you know, which one's right? You know, for the mass range.
It's like not embedded observers.
Yeah. Okay. But I mean, it'd be helpful to actually know where there's an observational guidance on this.
So yeah, I mean, that's the thing is, so you have recipes, you try, so this is the, you know, this is the problem when you have this, where you, and even in the simple hydro, there are algorithms you can change, you're going to change the answer. The nice thing with simple hydro is, that is the physics, you know, we're trying, okay, the only thing we're trying to do there is we're trying to solve the Navier-Stokes equations, and we make the Euler assumption. That's, you know, and then the only issue we were dealing with was numerical issues. And in fact, we could even, if we put up the viscosity, then we can say, oh, codes are okay, we've resolved it. But even there, the recipes still have this problem.
If they don't agree in the high viscosity limit, then I think you can start to make a verification statement.
Yeah. So then there's, well, but in this mixing, at the amount of mixing in the high viscosity, unless the high viscosity is really causing extensive mixing, your recipe will get a different answer. Okay, so the next thing is, you should ask, does my recipe really mask the physics? Because a lot of times what happens is we have a recipe that's physics-based. You know, it has some physics into, you know, there's some physics intuition going into it. But it doesn't, it's not going to be what you really do. It's not what nature is really doing. You're putting in that recipe. So you're putting in something that is maybe okay in some scenarios, but not okay in others. Engineers do this all the time. We have recipes. So nuclear power, apparently, the way we design new nuclear power plants, we use diffusion for the neutrons, mostly. So mostly they're using diffusion. That will get you the wrong answer. So what do? They change the cross sections. And that gets you the right answer. So you can do that, and you're validating, right? You're doing a study, and then you're validating. Now, the issue with the nuclear power plant is once you design it, you can test it. If it's not good, you can start it over. It doesn't blow up. It's all fine. But you can do, I mean, there are, in fact, most of my floor is nuclear engineers, and they are experts in the higher order transport. It's just that is too slow for a lot of design, so a lot of companies don't use them. But they do provide, you know, higher order transport to do this kind of thing, and then you go back to different opacities. But the issue is, if you're validating on a improper, you know, it's not that those cross-sections are wrong. Those nuclear cross-sections aren't wrong. It's just that our transport's wrong, so we're correcting. We're making two wrongs to make the right answer. And that's something you have to be aware of. Now, the way nuclear engineers get around this is they do...
Maybe they compensate exactly at some particular design point.
So, yes.
But not everywhere.
And so here's the deal. What nuclear engineers do is they do a series of experiments. Yeah. And then they have their calibrated code and they want this answer. When your set of experiments are really all around and you've tested and you've calibrated on all this space, you're not going to be too far off when you stay within that region.
But usually you don't calibrate in a region when it's about to blow up, right?
So this is, yeah, but the point is that when they do their calibration, they've done experiments all around that area. They're not trying to design something out here.
Yeah, but that doesn't change the possibility that there might be not one single correction.
So this could still be bad, but this is really bad. Now, let me explain a situation.
No. So, like, suppose I've got a discrepancy at all of these design points that you've talked about here, and I choose a value that minimizes the L2 norm of the discrepancy across all of them, for instance.
Yeah.
Then I'm still not passing through all of those actual measured points. I'm passing optimally close to them, but not through them.
Yeah, that's right. But it's, I mean, the issue is, and in practice, typically, unless it's really nonlinear, you're okay, you know, moving in. But you're really not okay here. But this is exactly what I've seen. And so I was even on a project where Sam Jones was doing stellar models, and he was using MESA, and he and Falk had really thought about how are they going to do the mixing, and they calibrated on low mass stars. And they had what Falk said has to be right, and so he insisted on using that same value for high mass stars. And so he calibrated over here, and then they did a calculation over here, and the MESA code for something like 10 or 11 or 12 solar mass star made a 1.9 solar mass iron core, which I don't think is right. If it is right, my whole picture of supernova goes away. So I mean, but I think we're not that bad. You just have to know you can't calibrate. If you're going to validate and you're going to do some stunt like this, where your physics is not really the right physics, you're just mimicking it and validating, you then have to be aware when you move off of that validation point. Now, it can still be bad even in here. But the point is that we're stuck with this, right? We're stuck with typically recipes that don't match. You know, if you compare the 3D simulations of shell burning layers, they are not encompassed by mixing theory. And that's where I wanted to say, I'm going to put a push for what Dave Arnett is pushing now for doing mixing, which is going to the next level. And this is, again, an engineering approach, the next level of approach for doing mixing, and that's doing Reynolds average Navier-Stokes solutions. So you have your equations, and I'll just quickly. You have something where you're trying to solve your Navier-Stokes equation, and here's a simple version of that, where you have, you know, derivatives in all directions. You're looking at the velocities. U is going to be my velocities for every particle. I have some force on an external force. I have a pressure gradient, and I have my viscosity term. And the whole thing Rands does is, I'm not going to do much on Rands. I'm just going to put its main assumption is, I'm going to take my velocities, and I'm going to assume them as an average velocity plus some fluctuation term. And then I'm going to tailor the expand the heck out of it, and I'm going to solve this equation. And then what happens is I say, oh, I have this infinite series Taylor expansion. I have all these derivatives. They keep on getting bigger and bigger. I have to close this somehow. And they close it. And that's what engineers typically do. But the advantage of this is I have a whole bunch of terms that I can look at my 3D simulation and say, what is the best physics to match my terms for my 3D simulation? And that's what Dave Arnett is doing right now. That's why he talks about Rand's models. He has at the beginning of his paper saying, you know, if we had known more about this when we started mixing in theory, we might have done something different. Now, the issue with Rand's models is they're still not perfect. We do the same thing, and I'm going to give another example of where we make a mistake. We did it was called a shock shear experiment. We had two shocks going like this, and we were looking at the Kevin Helmholtz instability as these two shocks passed each other. And we asked the question of, you know, we're gonna solve for our Rand's coefficients based on this. And I was not doing this experiment. I was on the review of the experiment. And the review team sitting there looking, and we see, if you look at the experiment, I didn't get a picture of this experiment, but it's great. If you look at the experiment, it starts to expand even before the two shocks start shearing against each other. And what was happening is there were some hot electrons leading the shock, heating it, and making it expand. So we weren't getting the right Rand's coefficients from that experiment because we were using this turbulence model to mimic both the turbulence and the electron heating. And so we were, again, not doing the right thing. But you know, now we have that. We have the electron heating in there. So now, typically, we're solving for those Rand's coefficients. But we, you know, what they would typically do is try to find individual Rand's coefficients and hope that they're the same in whatever problem we're doing. I think in astrophysics, the more straightforward way here is going to be you do the 3D simulations and then try to fill the Rand's coefficients. And that's what Dave Arnett is doing right now. I think that has you can really get something that matches the physics better. And I think in the end, that's where we're going to have to go if we really want to get to the point of calibrating what we're doing. Because I think right now, mixing link theory by itself is not, you know, you're allowing something that is not the right, really the right physics, but what you're doing is trying to match some observational data points, so you're changing, tuning it to get that physics, but then you have the problem that you may be predictive in this area, but you don't need, not necessarily, but you're certainly not predictive when you go out in this region. So the funny thing is, in Los Alamos, I'm known for being extremely anti-Rand's models, because I want us to be moving to 3D and moving away from Rand's models. But there's, if you look in industry, there's a lot of, they have these hybrid models where they're using IELTS or LES and doing IELTS with a Rand's model for boundary conditions. So they're doing tricks like this to try to get better and more accurate models. Rand's is a big thing in a lot of engineering fields. And it's the reason it's so big is it's very powerful. I can take that series out until I get the solution that matches what I see in my multi-D calculation. So I can try, or what I see in an experiment. It's just that we make a lot of mistakes with it as well. Did I have anything else?
I have a question, Chris. So you've got this region where you make small errors, or hopefully small errors, and then you've got this place out here where you shouldn't extrapolate. And if, let's suppose you don't have observations out there. Is there a way that you can tell from, let's say, the behavior of the error within this neighborhood of points where you do have observations, what the size of the region you can safely extrapolate to is?
I don't know it. I mean, I know the way it's easier in transport where we kind of can do what I would say is the equivalent of a DNS. It's Monte Carlo, and we can resolve the heck out of it. And there are a few errors with Monte Carlo, and we know how they behave. So there's a few things that even if I resolve Monte Carlo to the end of time, there are things that Monte Carlo does wrong, but I know what it is. And so I can look for those effects, and then I can say I can make a test here, and I trust my Monte Carlo over here. For turbulence, I'm always a little bit more cautious in saying that I can do this. This is why I'm pushing Rand's, though. They're more physics-based. They have terms that make me feel like if I can fix this term, I didn't write the equation, start getting really long, but there's lots of coefficients. If I can fix a coefficient, then it's valid for a wider range of parameter space. But I can't think of an example where that's really, I felt good about that. In fact, I'm pushing Rand's right now. At Los Alamos, I keep on saying, you can't do this. You can't extrapolate. So I'm having trouble defending it too much, other than Rand's is certainly better than what we're doing in stellar evolution right now. That's the thing that so I know it's the next step up. It's not the final solution.
So these errors, right, there must be some random component and some smoothly varying component that has different polynomial indices, right? And so what you're saying then is, like with Rand's and similar types of models, that because it's based on a formal Taylor expansion that is guaranteed to converge within some neighborhood, and, you know, that there's a straightforward, let's say, integral representation or integral averaging that's being done on that gives you, that convergence is what gives you the confidence that there's a neighborhood within which the whole model converges to something that's like the right answer.
Yeah.
Whereas with a model that's not based on some sort of expansion like that, like mixing link theory, maybe there's some high order dependencies or things like that. Maybe it doesn't have a convergent representation.
And it's, yeah, exactly. So there, that's better stated than I stated it.
Could you say again what RANS means?
Reynolds average, Navier-Stokes. And then the last thing that I wanted to say we should worry about is, you know, the question is, am I missing any physics? Because if you're going to compare two observations or an experiment, and you're missing a key piece of physics, this can be bad. And we just did an experiment where we were, again, it's amazing how poorly we predict simple experiments. I had a thin layer of beryllium. I shoot it with a laser, and it sends this beryllium through a low density foam, and it creates a shock, and we were going to observe the compression of this low density foam, get its temperature and its velocity, and learn something about the equation of state. So we're doing it. None of our models match the data. And it turns out, in the end, we put in another piece of physics was these lasers hit this beryllium, and they actually excite some of the electrons and send the electrons streaming through this foam. And they heated the foam up to a couple eV, so a few times 10,000 Kelvin. And then if I heated up my foam and ran the shock through, I did match the QMD calculations of the equation of state, but only then. So what we had missed, the physics we were missing was the, you know, electron, you know, the production of electrons. Is there an example in stellar astrophysics? Well, the one that I still worried about, and I don't want to get too many people angry at me, but I figure I might as well go for broke. We talk about stellar winds, but we also know that a large fraction of stars are in binaries. And if I'm, you know, and I remember the old days when we were calibrating the winds to match the number of Wolfer A stars and the 1B, 1C supernova, you know, not 1C because we didn't have them in the old days. But you were trying to match these Wolfer A stars, you had to have really strong winds. But the picture changes, we had a whole discussion yesterday, LBV stars, what are you doing? The picture changes if binaries are involved. So you don't want to, if you calibrated your physics ignoring binary effects, you're going to get a different answer than if you put in the binary effects. So when it's all fine to say I'm going to validate against observations, but if I'm missing a key piece of physics, then I'm not doing the validation process I thought I was doing.
But that is not the right comparison. If you want to validate, say, your wind classes, you should not compare something that is very indirect, like numbers of O stars to Wolf rates. You should actually check your theoretical rates to your observational rates. That's a direct validation of your physics.
And that's the way you can do it. But even then, we have an example, right? Because the wind, as we learn more about as our observations of the wind mass loss rates got better and changed, that changed some of our mass loss rates. So, clumping, things like clumping changed the answer, right?
Sure.
The answer, so I can tell you, and we all know this from 20 years ago, the wind mass loss rates are lower than they were 20 years ago.
The empirical rates are lower than they were 20 years ago, not the theoretical ones.
Okay, so somehow when they get plugged into the codes, they got a different answer. So mass loss in stars has now gone down for stellar models. So it may be that the physics is all right, but somehow the way we plug it into our codes has changed by a factor of 3. That's more than most of my engineering problems. Engineering problems, we're worried about 20% effects. I realize we're astronomers, we're worrying about factors of 3. But we need to, doing this kind of methodical approach is important. So when you're doing these, it's good. Somehow, when winds are, there is an uncertainty in mass loss rates when we plug them into our codes. And you see it, different codes are getting very different answers for mass loss rates still. But there's lots of places where we're missing physics. We've talked about it a lot, even in the week and a half I've been here, where people are saying, oh, I have to add this. Gravity waves, how are I putting in the gravity waves and the energy they deposit? How do I put those in? And you would get them there is a place in the RANs where you could add that in. So you could add a term that was a gravity in that expansion. So you can get some of this physics in with the RANs prescription. So there's, I mean, these are just some basic ideas that are more, I mean, we're not yet embracing it in stellar astrophysics. In fact, we're not embracing it in engineering all the time. But embracing these will make it much easier. It'll make it much easier to get to the right answer. So you won't have the mistakes that we kind of made in our high energy density physics, where almost every experiment we start off and then we realize things we did wrong. We either didn't understand our errors and we didn't, so we didn't, know exactly what, we didn't do a full UQ analysis. I still haven't seen one in stars, and my guess is if we did one in stars, the errors would be huge. But I think if you really want to be honest with that, you have to say, I don't know this to this amount, this is how it changed my result, and then I have these 10, 15 errors, and I'm going to study all of them and do an error analysis. That's what we have to do in engineering to get an accurate answer. I don't know how this applied physics problem is different than any other applied one that I've seen. I think we have to be doing that and doing the error analysis. Now, I'm happy for people to come up with, make a list of the errors. That's how I was going to end, is have people make a list of the errors. But I don't need to do that for this talk. I think that's what everyone wants, everyone should be doing, is coming up and thinking about what are the list of their errors, how much should they be worrying.
Chris?
Yeah.
Can you comment on how to deal with the degeneracies when you try to do the validation over the observation?
Yeah, when you have a thing and you have lots of errors. Yeah. Well, then it gets, but doing the opposite is wrong, right? So the thing is finding your first solution that works. That's not what you want to do.
Sure.
What you do then is you say, so it's a mess, and so I don't know the solution because of the example I showed you where we did the errors. I ended up saying, we can't say anything. That's what I ended up saying. So that was our paper, was we can't say anything about the equation of state and opacity. It may be wrong, but we can't say it because our one data point isn't good enough. Now, which I can tell you what we did, we're trying to take more data. And maybe 15 years from now, I'll be able to tell you whether the equation of state or the opacity is wrong. I don't know a quick solution to this other than, find the phase spaces that still give the right answer, and then once you find them, you can say, oh, I need to understand this physics better. Go do 3D simulations of that, and that will help beat down on it, right? Go do a study on that.
So with your laser thing where you realized that you were exciting electrons and they were preheating the foam, how did you realize that that was what you needed to add?
Because
it seems like what you could do is you could try, artificially preheating the foam and see, there needs to be something that does that.
So that is what we did. That is what we did. We initially artificially preheated the foam, and so it gets the right answer. And then we asked the question, what could be causing that preheat? Could it be X-rays?
Yeah.
And we went and checked that and said, no, it's not X-rays. They get absorbed.
Yeah. Okay, but that could have happened over previous experiments comparing the equation of state and the opacity. And the difference there was that you understood the errors, or you figured out what the errors were, and you decided that they were larger, they were large enough that variation wasn't needed. Do you understand the errors in this experiment?
So this one, we did the same study we did with that one as far as playing with the foam, inhomogeneities, drive uncertainties, these kinds of things, and that was not enough. So we did, we did do that, the same study we learned from that experience, we did the same study here, that did not make the difference. So we were missing, we realized we were missing yet more than what we had put in. So I'm not saying we understand the errors, but we at least did the same, we worried about the same errors that we worried about for that first experiment, and that was not sufficient.
But that sounds dangerously like, I varied this parameter and I got the result, and so then I stopped and concluded that all
so,
we needed to
so do this is the, something. So the thing we worried about is, the first thing we came up with was electron scattering.
Yeah.
And then we went and started to make a list of what else could do the preheat. So that's when we added X-ray. So we started to think, what other things could have caused this? Because we really wanted to prove, the way we're going to test this is you go and measure the electrons. But we have not done that second experiment. But what this ends up doing, unfortunately, this usually gives you more questions. So we said, okay, here's our list of things that we think might have done it. We could rule out X-rays; the opacity is too high. Electron scattering on first blush, because we added that electron transport into the code, and it gives an answer that seems reasonable. The next step is to put something over here that detects the electrons coming out. And that's the plan of that experiment. So that's how you would go. And if we don't see the electrons, then we know we're back on the drawing board. And you do this. The problem is, and the fear you can have is, we haven't built up, are there other fit pieces of physics that we're missing? We certainly studied all the, we took what we learned from before, all the errors from before, and we said, can this explain the result? None of, inhomogeneities in the foam, weird spectrum in the drive, and that's the weird spectrum in the drive got us to thinking we might get some electrons, because if we depending on what the spectrum exactly was, we got more spectrums. But in this case, the spectrum can't be that far off, because it's actually coming straight from the laser. So it's not. The other case, it was a whole room, and a whole room modeling is notoriously hard to do. I agree with Frank. We're in this, bonanza of frontiers. We're in that situation. I think what happens is you find something and you say, I'm going to study it better and try and kill it as a knob, right? So things like, the mixing is always going to be hard, but you can start to beat down on it, and these 3D simulations will help you beat down on it. There are other things that are easier that we're typically not worrying about. When we do our transport, most of the codes that I know that do transport within their stellar evolution code, you're doing 1T transport. Is that still true? By 1T, the radiation and the matter are assumed to be the same temperature. Is that true in the same?
No.
You actually have the radiation is a different. So you're solving the Boltzmann equation.
But in codes that are trying to do light curves.
Of course, when we do supernova light curves, we do something different. But in the interiors, it's and then you do gray transport, right?
Yep.
So the question is, how different is the Rosalind opacity gray to a multigroup, even still Rosalind, because Rosalind probably still reasonably good. How different is the multigroup Rosalind opacity for your path? And then the question is, how, Rosalind has some assumptions to it. I think they're pretty good for stellar models. But think about when is that wrong or right? For us, in a lot of our applications, going from gray to multigroup made a difference. So, of 10%, but it's 10%. So you can make a difference of 10-15% in that. So there's places where you can find smaller errors, but they start to add up. So write a list of where your errors are, go through and say, how am I going to pick on these and destroy them? And the thing that I've tried to convince Lanel of is, don't try to do the one, if you can't do it yet, if you can't do it, design an experiment or do something to study it, don't. Do the ones you can. Even if they're not your favorite ones, the ones you want to study, do the ones you can do today. You can leave the next problems for your grandkids, to solve. You don't have to solve all of these. I will tell you, we're studying opacities. I don't know if you guys have been reading the literature on iron opacities, but there are iron opacity experiments that say we don't know anything about iron opacities. I don't believe that, but we have an experiment that says we're getting the bound free wrong. The atomic physics is getting the bound free wrong. That's what the experiment says right now. I think the experiment's wrong. But
how far are the experiments conditioned up from those which we have in massive stars?
We're about 100 eV. The experiment goes up to about 100 eV, so you're looking at, and it'll be less dense, you're looking at 1 to 10 grams. per centimeter cubed for the iron, well, 10 grams per centimeter cubed for the iron, and 100 eV, so 10 to the 6 Kelvin. But understand that I think the atomic physics is better than that. But if you, it's a Nature paper out maybe 2 years ago, and Los Alamos is actually doing more experiments to prove that experiment wrong, right? That's, well, at least that's our hope. But the, you know, one of my jobs is to decide what do we do here. If you guys think you have a better test of opacities, please let me know, because I would love to, you know, if we have an astronomy test of the opacity, that would be great as a counterpart to the experiments we're doing. Yes, Stan.
So I'd like to comment about the issue of the Rosslyn opacity. So the basic idea, of course, behind it is that when you go deep inside of a star, the diffusion equation applies for radiation transport, and that basically what you're doing is you're ensuring that you're basically trying to model the flux-weighted mean opacity as being from this diffusion of photons. And a key point about this is that it's an inverse harmonic mean. It means that the strongest opacities you have are the weakest contribution, for instance, from lines. Unless they become a huge number of lines, like in the iron bump, you don't get much effect from lines. The photons will always avoid the lines. But that's predicated on this, on the basic classic model that the photons are diffusing and that the medium is static. And as soon as you make the medium have convection or any motion at all, then the velocity shifts that make these lines now change frequency from one place to the other. And the photons could easily sense that. And one of the ways you can see that is that the Planck mean of opacities is 1,000 times higher than the Rosslyn mean, because the lines then become very, very important. Because lines basically have a huge amount of opacity locked up in a little bitty frequency space. And so this is another point that I think that we completely overlook when we talk about convection and so forth. As soon as we break the classic idea that all we're doing is static, you know, a medium is completely static, no motion, that there's diffusion going on, then you get the harmonic mean of the Rosslyn mean. But as soon as you have any motion at all, then that's not necessarily going to happen, because now there's going to be Doppler shifts, and they're going to affect how the photons manage their way around these lines. And so this is something that I think is completely unexplored territory.
So there is some safety in this, in that the thermal broadening is included in most opacities that you grab. So you have the thermal broadening, and so as long as the velocity is much less, you know, than sound speed.
Well, but the line, iron has a thermal broadening width,
yeah,
because it's a heavy ion that's much smaller than the sound speed.
Yeah, yeah.
So you can have motion,
okay,
that is subsonic,
yeah,
super thermal.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Okay?
Yeah.
So this is an area that has been completely neglected as far as I can tell. And it becomes extremely important, of course, of how stellar winds get driven, because basic reason why stellar winds get driven is you're going over from Rosslyn mean now to a velocity stretch mean, which,
yeah,
basically allows then the opacity that's locked up in lines to now be released and drive this powerful outflow. And so this is something that I don't think in the context of stellar interiors has been even looked at.
Right, and we all know that this is critical for supernova Likert, so everyone has some kind of expansion opacity in their
respiratory. In terms of modeling what you see.
But there it's easy, you know you need it, because the velocity is really high. This is the case where you're, I hadn't put into context the fact that the iron is not moving, its thermal broadening is much less than the lighter elements, and so yeah, you are going to get the opacity wrong. So it's going to make a shift in your opacity. Just, and in fact, I would argue that how we implement opacities, I'm trying to convince my atomic physicist friends that it's how we implement opacities that's the big error, not the atomic physics. And so again, with this experiment that I said it looks completely wrong, my argument has been in the past that we are getting, there's turbulence there, and we're messing, you know, it's changing the result. In that case, we've actually argued you're not getting the right answer, because you're not, you know, you're, that's why I think this Nature paper is wrong, although why you need to actually explain why a Nature paper is wrong is another thing. But I think the reason this iron opacity is wrong is they were missing that physics, like what Stan is saying. So I think there's some of these you'll go and do them and it'll be a very small effect. And it's fine, but you got to rule it out, and then you got to check that box and say, okay, I've worried about this. This is where it is, and the problem is, someone studies a new condition. I'm not sure you can rule it out there too, but you got to I think we do have to pick at these like the way. So you know, there's a whole set of what Los Alamos does is studying this little nitpicking a lot of these physics, because we're worried about these errors, and because we actually.
Because you're engineers.
Because we're engineers. Yeah, and we still have our engineering hat on. So. Any other? Yeah.
I love this. But how do we solve the sociological problem where someone who comes along with a plausible-looking solution and confidence is overvalued compared to the people who worry?
Give the people who worry jobs, right? I mean, that's the biggest thing is that, and this is my biggest fear in astrophysics is, the people that do the flashy one-off solutions get the jobs more likely. And I'm fine with doing that, because what I've done at hiring at Los Alamos is finding the ones that are the nitpickers, and they're not getting a job anywhere, so they're willing to come to Los Alamos, and we're hiring. Right? But I think really what the astronomy community has to do is say, oh, that's something we appreciate, and we need to hire it. And I'm going to look at the, I'm finding the observers in the room. The observers have to say they want it. So time and time again, I get frustrated. I work part in the cosmic ray community. They don't seem to care whether I have a real physics model or, the observers in cosmic rays don't seem to care whether I have a good model or a bad model for my cosmic ray transport. I don't want to work in that field if they don't care. And so this is the thing, is you should tell your theorists. I saw it once. There was a talk by Tom Machanka, and he had given a series of talks for a while, and Brian Schmidt stood up and said, why should I believe you this time? And that's what you want, as an observer, be mean to us. Why should you believe us? Make us do that next step. And also punish us when if we're wrong too many times. Then you say, look, this person's wrong often. I would rather hire when I'm filling my department opening, I want to hire someone that's done more careful work. But the problem is these guys doing these careful studies don't get as many papers.
A lot of observers are happy to take an evolutionary track and as if it's something real.
Yeah.
Something other than totally hypothetical. And part of the reason is because there have been many years of talks as stellar evolution theorists at massive star meetings showing their new grid of models or whatever, and not articulating, how much of it is BS.
Yeah.
So I think there needs to be pretty honest communication that, this model does this, but if I change this parameter, it'll go in a totally different direction, and you should, but it's hard for people to get up and give a talk and say, here's why you should not believe me.
I think that's what we want, is we want to say, this is what, you should require people to, you want them to be saying, this is why, these are the things I'm worried about with what I'm showing you. Because it's not, you should trust a theorist any time. But I think, if I was giving this talk on, and you'll see this when I talk about supernova, there'll be parts where I believe what we're saying, but I would never tell you, you give me this star, and this is going to be its energy and remnant mass and stuff. We're not at that phase.
Chris, given by the existing founding models, which I actually understand exist in the US, there's absolutely no chance to get a fund to verify a model, right? There's a chance to get some funding to get a splashy.
Sociology.
It's sociology, but it's not sociology at the level of departments. It's sociology at the level of NSF, right?
Yeah, well, it's okay. The funding has a problem where, I don't know. I don't know how to fix this, because funding agencies actually think you're going to, in 3 years, you can solve some long-standing problem. They can't do this in mathematics, right? I mean, I've never been on an NSF math review, but you can't say I'm going to solve this 500-year math problem in 3 years.
That's why they don't give out grants.
Yeah, they don't. And maybe, I think, you know, we are the people that are on the committees. We can actually spend some time talking to the program manager and saying, you do know that the problem's not going to get solved in 3 years. I have trouble even in my internal lab funding, because people are writing, in 3 years I'm going to solve this problem. And you're looking at him going, we all know this can't be. The guy that's heading it is a scientist. It's Bill Podorsky. He knows you don't solve something in 3 years. And yet the proposals have to solve something in 3 years. And that's, if science went that way, great. But that's not been my experience. I think you keep pushing, you keep explaining to people, but it's a hard problem.
What I would like to say is that I think too often we like to think of these things as simulating nature, simulating reality. And I think that's a fool's goal. It's an impossible task. The best I think you can do is to do a well-posed experiment that teaches you physics, that helps you understand a problem like stellar evolution or stellar structure or stellar winds better, and then hopefully go back and improve, the feedback between observations and theory. But we should give up on this idea that what we're really trying to do is simulate the real world, because it's impossible to test. The real world is far more complex than we can ever put inside a computer, no matter how big a computer we ever have. What we can try to do is identify certain key principles that help us understand the basic problems of how a star is born and evolves and so forth. And we're never going to get to some final perfect thing. If we did have a computer that was big enough, we wouldn't be able to understand the output of it. It would be too complicated. So I think we should always go for this idea that, to find good problems that basically can teach you something about some component of the physics that's a subset of what's actually going on inside the real star. And if we do that approach, I think we do make progress in a steady sort of way. And it becomes hard to, get to some final perfect understanding. Errors, there's always going to be some issues that are going to be unsolved. But by doing these kind of controlled experiments, like you're trying to do, some of us are like, okay, let's give up on a really complicated thing. Let's find a relatively simple experiment we think we might have the chance of understanding and exploring. And I think it's important to identify those kind of simple problems, relatively simple problems, within the broader goal of what we're trying to do, whether it's in stellar winds or within stellar interiors or stellar structure or convection, try to understand them as a subset and not try to make this idea. Not to say that it isn't very useful to have a tool like MESA, which allows us to do experiments as we vary these things, these inputs, and say, how does that affect, but we have to realize that we're never getting close to actually simulating a real star or something like that.
Yep. Do you know that this is all being recorded?
Yes, this is what yeah.
So it was thinking that was heretical there?
Well, I was thinking, so I completely agree that we should be trying to solve well-posed problems. And in engineering, of course, when you're building an airplane that people will fly in, you're not satisfied with simply getting a better understanding of how planes fly. You want to build a plane that won't break up at within its design envelope. And in our case, we try to reproduce the behavior of stars or whatever physical system you're simulating well enough that people can make decisions about very expensive experiments, for example, to do, or to use those as inputs to other calculations that they're going to use to derive conclusions about some very different physical system. In our case, stars and the behavior of stars then goes into determination of where
galactic evolution.
Yeah, exactly. And so I don't think we can just be satisfied with throwing up our hands and saying, well, we can never really simulate the physical system and just gain some little bit of information about how the real system works. We really do want to get more accurate simulations of a population.
I'm not disagreeing with that. I'm simply saying that anything that we do is inherently a model. It may be quite accurate in ability for it to explain observations of how stars evolve, nature diagram, what the ionizing flux is for the. Those are things that are all laudable goals. I'm not saying you can't make progress on those. It's just that you have to understand, you have to have a certain humility that you're never going to really get all this physics in there. And that what the best thing that we can do is to try to identify problems that we can improve our understanding about. And then put that into basis, put that into, you know, predictions about how stars would evolve. You know, account for things like binarity or even multiples, you know, and mergers. These are all well-posed problems that I think are important to do. But we have to, I think if we try to think of it as being, we're going to come and make somehow bigger and bigger computers are going to make, you know, more and more. I think that has its limitations, is what I'm basically getting at. And that we should, in the spirit of what Chris says, hire people who can identify good problems and be skeptical about, you know, the big giant machine. You know, I mean, it was Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. What is it? Or was it? Yeah, was it the one they had? You know, what was the final answer to the ultimate question? You know, and everybody waits billions of years, and it says 42. You know, it's not going to be like that. It's not going to be that simple. And we should just. It doesn't mean we don't make progress, and it doesn't mean that we. I just think we have to understand that we're never simulating nature in its full glory.
We try to make models of how nature works, but that still is pretty successful. I mean, if I look at the single star evolution, which Ibn used to do, you could already explain quite a lot of things which you see in star clusters. It's argument. And so I think one shouldn't be too pessimistic also.
Well, and I also think the work where you just find one solution that works, and that's all you've done, that's also good. It's just, it cannot be that's the only thing we do. You know, we have to do this other, we have to do all of the studies. So it's not just, you know, because there's one thing proving that there is a possible solution within our grasp. If you see something and there's just no way to explain it in any other way, you know, you look at your stellar evolution code and you play with everything and you can't match it. That tells you you're missing some physics. And so that's a good, you know, there's good studies, and if you find one solution, you can at least say it's solvable. Whether I found the right one, you know, whether I found the unique solution is one thing, but I have found one. So I think all of the science is good. It's just, I think we're in now this phase where we're in a phase where we can start doing more. So the stuff that Stan's talking about is what we can do more that we have, you know, I think we can really push harder on.
Yeah. I mean, the sort of behavior you're talking about with funding agencies and so on, I think given the competitiveness of the environment and maybe their mindset, even if scientists in high positions, is intolerant of the ambiguity that's, you know, sort of inherent in this whole approach of considering errors.
So I remember being on a committee where, and I think it was long enough ago because it was over a decade ago that I can list some names, but Roger Chevalier had a proposal in where he was going to study something, but it was clear making steady but sure progress. And then someone else had a proposal that was going to solve everything, and it was relativistic outflows. So Roger was building on stuff that he'd already spent a lot of time doing, set off blast waves and stuff like this. And the other person was going to solve everything. And we're in this committee, and I'm sitting there, and I said, look, you know Roger's going to make progress. Everything he's done has been great. This guy has not done anything yet, and that's going to solve the problem. Who should you fund? And they all funded that guy, because he said something. And it was me against the rest of the committee. And so Roger did not get funded, and the other guy got funded, and I was, you know, that's the kind of thing that I want to see change. No, of course he didn't solve it. I mean, if you promise, I mean, I'm on a proposal right now where it's DOE, and they, for whatever reason, they think we can solve everything. I shouldn't be saying it now. They think you can solve everything with this little bunch of money. It's like, no, we'll make progress. That's what we're going
to
do.
Well, I mean, people make claims like that because they've come to see the environment as favoring that kind of claim.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, so we need this, we need to kind of switch. I mean, so when I'm on a committee, I can tell you, so if you're putting in a proposal where I'm on the committee, and you tell me you're going to solve everything, it's going to be a downer for me. So I, at least I'm one person that's a downer. I'm more looking for someone with a realistic proposal. And I will certainly speak loudly on my committee saying, there's realistic and so you should be, I would prefer to have a realistic proposal.
Funding's really a loaded question, obviously. But we might look at the responsibility to the people you were talking about, the users of the models we're building to go off and do other stuff. It seems clearly a sort of caveat emptor, maybe it's saying that we're going to not give you any hints about which of these things are good or which are bad and how our uncertainties are. Seems like we might try to do a better job of, at least at that transaction level, educating the consumers in terms of what we think the uncertainties are of these models, as opposed to saying, this is what a star does versus this is what my Mesa model does.
So one thing I thought would be a nice direction for Mesa to go in, for instance, maybe this is just documentation, maybe this is part of how the code operates, is to document carefully all the different parts, all the different switches and parameters and things, where they're supported by observations and with references, and what sort of range of parameter space that's been actually checked in. And then when the user runs Mesa with some combination of parameters that is not supported, then it at least says, look, buddy, you're on your own here. And, you know, would that, I mean, that's obviously a lot of work. Yeah, that's a lot of work.
I'm an engineer.
But I think that would be an extremely useful thing, not just for Mesa, actually, probably for a lot of codes. Like, you know, a 3D Hydro code, Flash.
Yeah, at least, I mean, I get teased about the huge number of knobs that there are, but at least the knobs have been brought out to the surface.
Yeah.
A lot of codes, the knobs, they're surface knobs, and then there's an order of magnitude more of hidden knobs.
Right, exactly, yeah. Things are listed as a constant in the code itself.
I've got all the knobs out there for you to say, oh,
right.
God, there are a lot of knobs.
No, I'm not being critical.
No, I understand, but it's exactly what you're saying.
See the number of knobs in Flash, really. That's, yeah, it's,
the number of knobs reflects our ignorance.
Yeah, and while we have, like the Mesa documentation, we have, you know, in our documentation, actually it's sort of automatically generated a description of what each parameter does and sort of the range of values it can take. Mm-hmm. It doesn't tell you anything about what combination of parameters it's okay to use.
But it's not known.
It's not known.
It may not be known. Yeah, that's right. But each of these parameters in the Mesa was introduced for a reason, right? And so.
I want to make clear that I'm a great fan. I mean, in the title, the meaning, modules for experiment in stellar astrophysics, is perfect because it's not claiming to simulate reality. It's simply giving you some tools, bringing them to the surface, allowing it to be open source kind of thing. Whereas up until now, we've had these different groups that had these, they each had their own little codes and they had their own little switches and it was all buried. And all you, it was like you had to talk to the high priest. You know, this is where your code says this. And I think the fact that you brought it and made it possible for, you know, we've seen the tremendous productivity that comes out of that. And so I wasn't criticizing at all the approach of Mesa. I think people just really need to be realistic that we're never, whether we read it, even if we could make a 3D Mesa, we still wouldn't be simulating nature. There would be many, many knobs. Because of the physics is uncertain, and because there's, you know, nature is very complex. But as scientists, we don't have to throw up our hands and say that we can't solve the problem. That's not what I was saying at all. It's that we need to make progress by identifying key individual pieces of physics that can be broken off and then maybe put back. And that's the process of science.
Yeah, I mean, I actually argue this is what one of the strengths of doing binary population synthesis is. It identifies some of the physics that makes a big difference in, say, this binary population or that binary population, common envelope being one of them, and say, look, go understand this. This is an uncertainty we need to deal with. And so I you know, you kind of, this is the problem with the solution to this is it's a free-flowing thing where you're doing detailed models, you're doing detailed observations, you're doing these, you know, you're providing nucleosynthetic yields for galactic chemical evolution. I'd be really scared if I was doing that. We actually formed a collaboration called Nucleosynthesis Grid, NuGrid, with the idea that we were going to give error bars on the nucleosynthetic yields. 10 years later, we're still struggling because it's bigger than we thought. You know, it's much harder. And fortunately, we picked younger people, but they're now all getting older. It's like Raphael Hirschman. 10 years ago, Raphael was quite young, but now, you know, he's, you know, the team is it's not clear we're going to see, you know, good error bars produced in our before we all retire. It's that hard, but you provide your best guess, and it goes. And this is what people, the stellar evolution community, has done this for years, where they provide their best shot. But I think being more honest with what you think your errors are would be the way that would help make things better. Because I will tell you, when I was in grad school, it seemed like stellar evolution was done, right? The common comment was, "We know stars; we're good with them." And I think we're in the bonanza frontiers period where there's lots we don't know, and we can go attack it.
But if you start admitting that there might be problems with single star models from the 90s, people will start questioning the IMF version 10.
Yeah. Well, that was depressing.
I want to make sure so I know when you and I get together using Bill, it's a deciding whether the second floor window is enough to end it all. But I think this is really what makes it exciting for me. There's a lot of problems. There's a lot we could be studying. And you know, it doesn't have to get solved and you know, Ed's lifetime or my lifetime. It's there's work to be done, and there's lots of fun stuff. So, I mean, look, Los Alamos can be excited about. I can get excited about radiation going down a tube. So for me, there's lots of neat physics that you could be doing. So I think I would say we should go away thinking we have this. I'm going to keep on saying Frank's thing because it makes me feel better. Bonanza of frontiers. So. Whatever that means, it seems good.